If you're looking for a hero, you're listening to the wrong man. I keep hearing Bill O'Reilly say, he is just too morally strong to do this, and too morally strong to do that, and he's never had a drink in his life, and anybody who never has a drink in his life is not going to be an alcoholic, and on and on and on and on. Well, old Bob crawled into alcohol and drug recovery back in 1989. I looked about 100 years old, a very unhealthy 100. And I remember, well, I actually remember relatively little about that time. I spent years in AA and Narcotics Anonymous, crawl back on my feet. So I am not an O'Reilly hero. During that period, I did have the experience of being in what's called the program, the recovery program. And one thing about the recovery program is that it's a truthful program. I had always heard all my life that the whole World War II generation, I'd heard from them about what heroes they were and how wonderful they were and how they make all these sacrifices. Sometimes I would hear them say they fought the war, as Pat Buchanan said, to open Europe to third world immigration. Or then they would say when their benefits, veterans' benefits, were threatened, they thought, or were not being raised, they'd say, I fought a war for those benefits. So I got a little confused about what exactly they fought the war for. But according to them, they were the heroes of the world. I have talked to people during my life on, I speak German. I spoke to people who were on both sides during the war. German, Italian, Japanese, American after American. One thing I have noticed is that the only people who think Americans made good soldiers were the Americans. I've never heard anybody anywhere make a good comment about Americans as soldiers except Americans. In fact, if it weren't for the Italians, we would be famous as having the worst soldiers in the world, which is not too surprising. That war was being fought in other people's backyards. And I guess Americans just don't make good disciplined soldiers. I know all the war movies always showed the Germans right after a battle. They looked like they had just cleaned and pressed their uniforms, and the Americans were very proud to show themselves as slovenly as possible. No, Americans weren't very good soldiers, but that was then and this is now. Now they were wonderful, unbelievable soldiers. In any movie, one American soldier can kill 82 Germans with one hand while having an emotional crisis. And in the alcohol and drug program, some of the older generation was there, and some of them actually told me some truths. And one of them was, one guy who had been in the Pacific during World War II, you don't hear much about the Pacific front because all the political lessons are about the Nazis, but my family was in the Marines in the Pacific, which was fairly rough duty. This old fella had been there for about 2 years. They finally dragged him off the front. His feet were rotting out from fighting in the jungle, and yet he still wanted to go back and join his buddies. So he was not exactly a mama's boy, even though he wasn't in Europe. And he told me that in one area, on one island that was sort of a headquarters, he and a bunch of other real combat veterans were there, and most of them were professional military, and there was a colonel in command there who, when he started drinking, he started bullying everybody. He would go to the officers' club and bump into people and insult people and so forth, and nobody dared say anything. Finally, one fella, he apparently really went overboard, probably insulted his wife and children or something. The fella finally knocked the hell out of him. Then the colonel brought him up on charges in court-martial. Now, this island had been, was full of combat heroes, the kind who actually had a lot more combat experience than most of the people from the European front who keep telling us about how wonderful they were. They all had physical courage. But this man who finally reacted to the insults and the punches was convicted because not one of those war heroes was willing to take the moral step of risking his career, his pay, and testifying for him, because that would have been sort of like a doctor who testifies on the wrong side in a malpractice suit. That would have broken the camaraderie of the officers. So, as he told me, they just plain chickened out. You don't hear stories like that. Man who has enormous physical courage has no moral courage at all, and as I keep saying, that is the story of the World War II generation. They claim unanimously to have been glorious soldiers, and every single one of them remembers himself as not as he was, but through the John Wayne movies, he sees himself as a hero, which makes you wonder why there were so many rifles left at Normandy. A lot of soldiers hit the beach and dropped their guns. So, there are our official heroes. They stand convicted of being human beings. There's nothing wrong with being human beings if you don't claim to be superhuman. And as I say, I've had many opportunities since being raised on the World War II generation's idea that if a sergeant told them to blow their nose and they blew their nose under orders, then they were suddenly heroes who deserved the public to support them for the rest of their lives. I may be overstating this for a lot of cases, but what bothers me is not that there are braggarts from the World War II generation. Who else would claim that they were superior to Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Nathan Hale or all the rest? What I'm going to go into now is the moral side of this equation. Again, everybody has braggarts, but they also have people who call the braggarts down. I remember an old guy on television on some talk program, and he was wandering around in his little World War II paper hat, and he was saying, "I fought a war." He was talking about people who wanted to close the borders to illegal immigration, and he said, "I fought a war against that kind of discrimination." Now, what bothered me was not that this guy was bidding for popularity with Donahue or whoever it was running the show, but that not one other World War II veteran stood up and said, "Well, I didn't fight a war for that." You never hear that. When Pat Buchanan said back in the 70s that the World War II generation went into Normandy to open Europe to third world immigration was what he believed then. I was arguing with him at the time. No, as far as I know, at least from what I said from him, not one World War II generation said, "Me and my dead buddies did not risk our lives at Normandy so that Europe could be opened up to third world immigration." Not one of them wanted to take that horrible racist stand back when the forces banning and condemning racism were so strong in the late 1970s. In fact, pretty well everybody, including National Review, were in favor by default of open borders. So, the fact is that moral courage is completely missing. Now, I said they call themselves the greatest generation. Well, what I mean is, when the book The Greatest Generation came out, if any other group of Americans had been called the greatest generation, some of them would have stood up and said, now hold it. I think we did a good job, but come on. There were greater generations than us, the people who starved to death at Jamestown. Half of them starved to death and came over heroically and had a much higher death rate among the women and children than they did among the World War II generation. Somebody would have said something, but nope, not in the World War II generation. Tom Brokaw wrote a book called The Greatest Generation, and as a professional writer, let me repeat to you what I said before. You write, if you're going to get published, you write for the audience, not for yourself. Tom Brokaw knew that that generation would buy that book. And that sold like wildfire. So the people who bought it were saying, yeah, we were the greatest generation. And nobody said anything else. That's what I call moral courage. Now, I feel that I spent my life surrounded by heroes. Now, when I say I was surrounded by heroes, I don't just mean heroes on my side. I mean heroes on the other side, too. There is an enormous difference between someone who is mistaken and someone who is evil. And when I say heroes, I don't mean John Wayne's out there dirty and disheveled and fighting the enemy in the field. Remember the example I gave you of World War II cowardice was people who had been out in the jungles and hitting the beaches in far more dangerous situations than most of those faced by Americans on the European front. And yet, where they cowered it out was not in dirty uniforms out in the jungle. They were abject cowards when it came to putting on their dress uniforms, or their, actually not dress, but full uniforms, clean and pressed, and showing up before a court-martial. Some of the greatest heroism I've ever seen was on the part of people who did it all in coats and ties. I was raised on the idea that you're not a hero if you're not wearing a uniform. You're not under orders, you're not a hero. I certainly got over that one because I watched a whole generation give everything worth having away. The greatest generation gave everything away after they had done their fighting and they got in their coats and ties and they got in their, went to their jobs. They started giving everything away. I never saw anything heroic about that generation, so I am somewhat embittered. I have seen heroes, and as I say, heroes on both sides, because of a little rule of life. And that rule is this. There were, when I was there, probably there are a lot more now, some 20,000 people working on Capitol Hill. And if you sit down with one of those people, and then you sit down with another of those people, you will have two completely different pictures of what goes on Capitol Hill. In my case, what went on Capitol Hill was that at 2 o'clock in the morning, the place was lit up like a Christmas tree. People working their butt off. Now, they could have worked 40-hour weeks, but they were trying to get things done. Then there are people who are selling out, obviously. I've known a certain number of congressmen who have gone straight from their seats in Congress to prison. And so there's a lot going on there that I didn't have anything to do with. I don't know anything about that side of Capitol Hill because I was busy working myself into two nervous breakdowns, alcoholism, and drug addiction by fighting day and night for what I believed in, and I was facing people who were just like me on the other side and on my side. That was my picture of Capitol Hill. So, since I was a fanatic, I can't say a hero, I remember far too many instances when I backed down, but at least I can say I was surrounded by people who were genuinely fighting for whatever it was they were fighting for. I despise what a lot of them were fighting for, but usually the ones who were selling out or the ones who were doing what was convenient went home at 6 o'clock in the evening. The people on the other side that I was fighting were there at 2 o'clock in the morning working their butts off to fight me. I had a great deal of respect, not for their opinions, Lord knows, but for the simple fact that they were willing to stick their necks out. They were willing to fight it out. I hate Teddy Kennedy with a passion, but Teddy Kennedy believes in what he is fighting for, and there's always, if you're any kind of warrior, you always have a certain sneaking respect for the guy on the other side who is really serious about what he's talking about. Actually, of course, most of the business on Capitol Hill doesn't break down that way. The big fights, of course, that we hear about are the ideological fights, and those were quite serious. But also, if I needed to get something done, the fellow that I called on the other end of the line would often be on the other side ideologically, but we needed to get something accomplished for a constituent or break through some legislation, all sorts of things. And when I needed to get something done, I very seldom called up the 40-hour-a-week types who write these books about how dirty Capitol Hill is. The fellow I talked on the other end of the line was clean as a whistle. And this disappoints a lot of people who love to read about scandal and stuff, but the average voter gets a lot more than he deserves as far as these workers on Capitol, the real workers on Capitol Hill are concerned. During the time I was on Capitol Hill, my congressman was on the Select Intelligence Committee. He was the senior Republican on that committee. And from that, a lot of other experiences I've had in my life that I don't talk about, I know that the real heroes in the Cold War were not the guys who were at the offices of the CIA and that crowd. Most of the officers of the CIA are a bunch of good old boys from Ivy League schools. Give you a little example. Torricelli of New Jersey got through an amendment that destroyed on-the-ground intelligence in the CIA. He was upset that the CIA was using all sorts of informants who had criminal records and were just bad people. Now, if you will talk to any cop about the informants he deals with, very few of his informants have completely clean records and are model citizens. By definition, your informants are going to be people who have shady backgrounds. But Torricelli didn't like that, and a lot of his squeaky clean comrades, he's in New Jersey politics, how he could have squeaky clean ideas is beyond me, but he did get through this amendment that said that if someone out in the field, the CIA, wanted to hire or to use an informant who had a shady background, a bad background, criminal background, anything like that, he could do so, but he had to clear it with CIA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now, as you know, Hansen and a bunch of other spies were in that old boys network, and everybody knew that the Ivy League has a pretty heavy sprinkling of the people that all, as one KGB or one worker, Soviet man who'd worked in Soviet embassy here said, everybody in the American service, whether they were from the Soviet Union, whether they were at the UN or janitorial work at the embassy, they were spies. Their job was to get American contacts. Now, they wouldn't have spent all that time getting American contacts and never getting any American contacts. These American contacts wouldn't necessarily be communists, but they would feel that there wasn't a whole lot of difference between communists and Americans. As Hollywood people keep saying, it was just hard to tell during the Cold War which side was the good guys. So, the CIA was run through, was controlled, and is controlled by a group of people who were raised or educated or and fit into the Ivy League crowd. And I think we all know what the Ivy League crowd feels about what they would call blind American patriotism and the idea that communism was evil and the West and the other side was good because we did all sorts of nasty things and therefore moral equivalents. The net result of this, just to demonstrate that my point was known by more people than me, was that not one single person in the CIA out in the field running local offices ever submitted one single name to anybody at the National CIA headquarters. He knew very well that if he submitted the name, it would go straight to the KGB. And I offer this as one piece of proof that's public that I can give. In the case of the Torricelli Amendment, not one single person even submitted one of these people's names. So it gives you some idea of how much trust the field had in the CIA. So I can't give my other examples, but that one is public record. Everybody knows the Torricelli Amendment destroyed on the ground in information for the CIA. And of course, most people don't remember that in the 70s, the CIA was also destroyed by Senator Church getting in there and exposing all sorts of operatives and everything else. I mean, it was a disaster for on-the-ground intelligence. He was a young liberal who, again, believed that there was a certain moral equivalence between the American and the Soviet systems. So I want you to look at that situation and realize what kind of people it took to get serious work done, even though they knew that they couldn't deal with the headquarters and all the money, and everything was controlled by the Harvard crowd and the Yale crowd. Well, how do you get around that? Well, you get around that by not being a careerist. A careerist has to satisfy the old boys club at home. The heroes of the Cold War were not like the Greatest Generation. The real heroes did not take orders to blow their nose from their sergeant. They had to do these things on their own, often at their own expense. And that's something else people don't notice. Once that money had to be accounted for inside the CIA, granted it was not public information, but that would have been the least of the problems. Hansen, the traitor Hansen, could have gotten hold of any record of any expenditures inside the CIA. So a lot of times it was a congressional budget thing. And there isn't much of a congressional budget. It's pretty well watched. In fact, a couple of guys I knew working for a senator from the South were about the last idea of heroes you'd ever see in your life. They were both kind of pudgy. They were, well, I can't give their exact ranks. They were top-ranked legislative people. They got into trouble helping the Contras in Central America. They stuck their neck out. They survived it, but it was touch and go there for a while. They could have been under criminal charges, and they knew it when they took the chance. And two, I wish I could show them to you. I've drunk beer with them. Two less likely heroes you've never seen in your life. Both of them were kind of dumpy, unheroic-looking kind of people. But then again, the Audie Murphy, who won two Medals of Honor in World War II, most decorated American in World War II, was from Texas, later became a cowboy star. But you really ought to see the picture of him on the front, on the cover page of Life magazine. He looked like a pretty boy, kind of little guy, and certainly nobody's idea of a war hero. I remember when I was on Capitol Hill, another kid there, I read in the paper that this staffer from South Carolina had been attacked by three blacks, mugged by them. All three of those blacks went to the emergency room in an ambulance, and he was back at work the next day. And I went in to see him, and sure enough, he wasn't all that weak-looking, but he certainly didn't look like a tough guy type, and he wasn't too impressed by the whole incident. Like the fellow says, be careful who you decide to fight with. The big, rough guy, it is often true that these little guys just won't take it. But anyway, I don't have to explain to you what heroes look like. They come in various shapes and sizes, and they come in various types. Now, I don't know if these sort of dumpy guys that got into trouble in Central America would have been great soldiers or not. They sure as hell would have had to get into shape and got back on the beer to do it. So everybody would say, well, you know, these are just a couple of operatives on Capitol Hill. But they had the kind of guts and initiative to get into that particular kind of trouble, which leads me to another little observation. I have noticed that people who are moderates tend to get into trouble with money and so forth. All of the people who got into trouble in the big scandal, I forget exactly when it was, a bunch of congressional leaders went to prison on that one. It was an FBI sting, and one of them, the one Republican caught, was actually stuffing money into his pockets on film. But these are not the extremists. People who get into trouble on money and power issues, money issues, personal issues, are people like Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon was always the moderate between Barry Goldwater and Rockefeller. When somebody like Reagan got into trouble, it was over Iran-Contra. He was making deals for something he wanted to do. And I don't know whether he's guilty or not, but that's the kind of trouble that these right-wingers or left-wingers get into. They get into ideological trouble for misusing funds, like North, Colonel North. They get into trouble with that kind of thing when they're trying to do something. The ones who go to jail for just plain old common ordinary dishonesty, look at their voting records, look at their whole image, and they're moderates. That's because, as I keep trying to explain to people, moderation is, by definition, dishonesty. You believe in one thing, but you don't think that you should fight for it because you can get elected office if you will just cool it and compromise on it. And it isn't a whole lot of distance between that, selling out your principles for election, and a few other little transgressions that are personal in nature. So I was always a little, well, not surprised, but I do note that nobody ever seems to notice that it's the moderates, Rostenkowski, people like that, who the deal makers, the compromisers, who get caught doing just plain nasty small things. The extremists have a tendency to get caught, but they generally get caught doing something for their cause. Some years ago, the Canadian Progressive Conservative Party, even the name gives you an idea of where they stood or did not stand. They had a majority of parliament, and they got into so much trouble with just dirty little deals that they dropped from a majority of the Canadian parliament to 2 seats all in one election. I believe Mulroney was the one who was the head of the party at the time, and he was a well-known moderate. He was conservative, but a progressive conservative, and so forth. And that party completely destroyed itself at the time. I haven't really kept up with Canadian politics since then, but I wasn't too surprised that a party dedicated entirely to watering down principles would find itself destroyed by scandal. I believe that after Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative Party in England did exactly the same thing. They got what they call the Wets back in control of the Conservative Party. And the Wets didn't just compromise their political principles, they sold out their personal principles too. Well, what exactly do you expect? Well, I will say that these were not the people I dealt with. Nobody tried to bribe me. When a couple of times, if anybody came around even vaguely to the idea of offering me something personal, I would make a general remark about how stringent the rules were on Capitol Hill or in the administration, and how a person could be forced, even though he liked somebody, to actually send them to prison if they started offering him bribes and so forth. That little pointed wandering off sort of gave them an idea that they were sort of tiddling right outside the prison if they were dealing with me. But everything I did on Capitol Hill certainly was not straight and proper, but what I did was on my own initiative and took risks that those war heroes out in the Pacific wouldn't take. Been out in the field, that I don't talk about. I've been in a lot of places, but to me, courage is courage, and the people I have been around, I'm proud to say, I hope it reflects well on me. I hope I'm bragging. I know too much about me to consider myself a hero. I wouldn't have ended up in drug recovery if I were a hero. But I do have a certain pride in the fact that the people I remember tended to be people who took initiatives, who did what was right, all the stuff that you simply do not associate with either politics or the Cold War. A lot of it was really nasty, but it was nasty in that particular way. So if you want honest government, as a voter, you're going to have to give up pleasing the press. Anytime a congressman or senator says something that is outside the bounds, the press condemns him, and everybody says, well, I like what he said, but he just shouldn't say it that way. So you get people who say the right words, you elect moderates. And as long as you elect moderates, you have to expect the dishonesty that is integral to moderation. This is Bob Whitaker, the Untrained Eye. Hope to talk to you again later.